Today we are actually at the final leg of our Broken series. And to be honest, I struggled a little with the title of the sermon. I was actually thinking that we should have titles that are a little bit more hopeful, a little bit more positive. But I decided, no, it's okay. We'll just state things as they are and pray and hope that God will reveal new things to us as we go along. Okay? Last week, Jörg spoke about various kinds of broken relationships. And he reminded us of the importance of knowing we are loved by God and that we have Jesus as our khaki, as he says, as our best friend. Today, I would like to focus on the brokenness of our families and how that impacts our lives and our relationships even now. We all know that our families of origin have a huge impact on our emotional makeup and our present-day relationships, right? But we may not be aware of the intricacies and the significance of how we carry some of these old wounds and brokenness into our current lives and our relationships. You know, family stirs up a mixed bag of emotions for most of us. While some families are able to give love and nurture, I would say all families have their own unique dysfunctions that contribute to each of us developing some perhaps unhelpful beliefs and assumptions regarding ourselves and others. Many of our beliefs and assumptions about ourselves and others were formed as we were growing up. And it's not always a conscious process, right? Some of those beliefs are good and helpful, such as, I'm cared for and a vital part of this family. But some can be rather damaging and unhelpful. Beliefs such as, I am only worthy of love and respect when I do well in school or in my career. Or, my thoughts and opinions don't really matter. As children, it was hard for us to distinguish between what is accurate and what is helpful and what isn't. So we believed and were consequently hurt by the unhelpful things that were expressed or modeled by the adults in our families. And we may not always be aware of how these old wounds continue to linger within us and how we are easily triggered by those who are close to us now. Why we feel so much pain and hurt when a close friend or partner does or says certain things. So as we close this broken series, I thought it might be valuable for us to just take a step back and reflect on how our families contribute to making us the people that we are today. Perhaps both the good and the not so good. And more importantly, how can we shed old patterns of thinking and ways of being that are not beneficial to us so that we can grow and transform into the people that God has made us to be. But first, let's look at what Jesus taught about the biological family, okay? Since we're talking about family today. You know, many people, and especially Christians, they proclaim that the family is the foundation of society. Now, I'm not saying that the family is unimportant. It is very important. But some of these people believe that the nuclear, heteronormative family is the bedrock of society. Therefore, they champion to protect and promote their version of family, usually a very narrow definition of family, and claim that any threats to this definition and formation of family is a threat to society as a whole, right? And we've seen that happen in Singapore as well. So I thought it would be interesting and perhaps very necessary for us to see what Jesus actually thought about the biological family. If you recall in the Gospels, Jesus didn't seem very big on the family, right? I mean, well, Jesus didn't marry or have children, a very highly unusual choice at that time. In fact, I think people would have found that rather suspicious. There were times his teachings seemed harsh, even disdainful of the Jewish culture and notions of family. When a potential disciple asks if he might bury his father, his dead father, before following Jesus, Jesus responded by saying, "Let the dead bury the dead." Sounds a little bit callous, right? Like, and that was in Luke, right? And if that sounds harsh, he even told the crowds that in order to follow him, they must hate their family. Do you remember that part? Right? And he says, large crowds were traveling with Jesus, right? And turning to them, he said, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple." Wow, I mean, heavy words. On another occasion, when informed that his mother and brothers were waiting to see him, he challenged people's definition of family by saying, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" he asked. And then he looked at those seated in a circle around him and said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does God's will is my brother and sister and mother." Clearly, Jesus wasn't very big on the biological family. And he was living in a nation that was obsessed with genealogies, if you remember, yes, and bloodlines. It was very important where you came from. People needed to know. To the religious leaders of Israel, one's bloodline and genealogy guaranteed salvation. They believed that was how God's grace was transmitted from generation to generation. But Jesus challenged that idea and completely redefines family for us. Charles E. Moore said, "Contrary to the tradition that salvation is guaranteed by ancestry, or that one's highest social obligation is to family, he," meaning Jesus, "reminded his listeners that the covenant that first drew God's people together was based not on bloodlines, but on faith and the miraculous power of God." And this is why Jesus dethroned the biological family. While he never denied the family's worth as a creation of God, he made clear that its importance is not absolute. It is not the primary means by which God's grace is transmitted to this broken world. Something else is. In Jesus' new definition of family, we don't just love our own. We don't just love our own. His is a radically new, expanded social order, a welcoming, open community not formed by ancestry or marriage, but one that is forged by a shared love and discipleship. It's a family that welcomes widows and orphans, strangers, people of all colors and backgrounds. In Jesus' definition, the church is not just made up of families. The church itself is a family. As you might be very familiar, this is something that we at Free Community Church strive to uphold. But I'm very aware of how far short we fall at being family for one another at times. And it's no coincidence that the overarching theme of our year is actually welcome home. The council had pondered about it, and we decided there was a need for us to re-examine and deepen and widen our understandings and combine experiences of welcome, what welcome really means, and home here at FCC. So even though we have noble aspirations, like any family, we experience hurts, conflicts, and brokenness at interpersonal and inter-ministry levels. As we pay attention to these areas of brokenness, I realize that many of our conflicts and hurts that we experience arise out of our individual beliefs and assumptions about ourselves and about others. Many of our beliefs and assumptions are significantly influenced by our family of origin. All of our families are different and dysfunctional in some way. And perhaps this is a good opportunity for us to go deeper into ourselves and become more aware of how the dynamics and the interactions within our families have influenced our own fears, our own expectations. And our tendencies to hurt and to be hurt. I think this in turn affects a lot of our relationships at work, at church, at home. I was thinking a little bit about my own experiences, and I'm sharing this with you because it's an invitation for you to think about your own as well. And if it comes back, it comes back, okay? I was thinking about my own experiences with my family, and I realized that while both of my parents were not eldest children, they were the de facto eldest children in their own families due to various reasons. They had to take on the responsibility of eldest children, and they really went and continued to go the extra mile to take care of their families and their siblings even now. Consequently, they had a lot of expectations of me as a child. They expected me as the eldest child to take on a lot. And although it was often unspoken. So I grew up taking a lot of responsibility for my siblings and the people around me. And perhaps to a large extent, maybe I did so to win the approval of my parents, although I wasn't conscious of it then. While being responsible is not a bad thing, it can be unhelpful when I take responsibility for other people's feelings or reactions. So I had to unlearn some of these old beliefs and patterns of behavior and learn to draw healthier boundaries for myself. I had to learn to take responsibility for my own feelings and allow others to take responsibility for theirs. It seems like such a simple thing, right, when you think about it. But it made a lot of difference once it became clear to me. Another thing I had to unlearn was that I don't have to earn the love and respect of others by excelling in school or in my work. My grandfather, my paternal grandfather, he grew up in poverty due to a series of famines in China at the time. I remember him telling me that his family was so poor, they had to choose which child to feed. And they couldn't afford to feed the female babies, so they let them die. It was horrifying and heartbreaking to hear some of his stories from that time. He left home in his teens to come to work in Singapore because he wanted to help provide for his family. He was very enterprising and determined. He managed to start a business after many years of hard work. He never had a chance to go to school and remained uneducated all his life. I still remember him trying to teach himself to read the Mandarin newspaper in his later years. Because of his background and his experiences, he highly valued education, and he wanted to encourage his grandchildren to excel to the best of their abilities. His values and desires were completely understandable, and his intentions were positive. However, families being families, I found myself growing up in a very competitive environment. Parents would be comparing the grades of their children every Chinese New Year. "So, what did your daughter get this year? My son did this." And I started to believe that I had to prove myself and my own worth through my academic achievements. Thankfully, this was something I began to unlearn when I became a Christian and slowly realized that God loved me even before I could do anything to deserve that love. In fact, God desires the wholeness of my being, not my doing. But it took time for me to unlearn these beliefs that I acquired as a child growing up. There are still many things that I'm discovering about myself and working on myself. And being in a relationship is oftentimes a helpful arena where old wounds and issues surface for healing, as we tend to trigger or we are triggered by the people closest to us. I think the key is not to fear these situations, but to recognize that these are opportunities for healing and growth if both parties are willing to work on themselves. So Peter Scazzero said, "We often underestimate the deep unconscious imprint our families of origin leave on us. In fact, my observation is that it's only as we grow older that we realize the depth of their influence. Each of our family members or those who raised us through childhood has imprinted certain ways of behaving and thinking into us. Likewise, our cultures, the media, our interpretation of events that happen to us also imprint onto us. These behavioral patterns operate under a set of what we call commandments, inverted commas. Some of them are spoken and explicit. Most are unspoken. They were hardwired into our brains and DNA, so much so that we sometimes simply bring these expectations into our closest relationships as adults." Peter Scazzero gives the example of how every family has their own commandments. And these are the values and directives about what's favorable and what's not. And we absorb and learn them from a very young age. They're both spoken and unspoken. Very often, especially in Asian families, I would say they are unspoken. A frown or raised eyebrow can convey annoyance or disappointment or warning about behavior that's not acceptable within this family. This is just an example of what a list of commandments might look like for a family, right? About money, about conflict, about sex or grief and loss, about feelings and emotions, anger. I wonder, what does your list of family commandments look like? What messages did you receive about gender roles, conflict management, money, sex, responsibility, the expression of feelings and emotions, etc.? Some of us have had or continue to have very difficult relationships with our parents. The other day, one of our church members was telling me he got very upset and affected when someone said something to him that sounded critical. He said it reminded him of his mom and how she often puts him down. And this happens to all of us, right? Often someone may say something that can trigger an old wound for us. And as a consequence, our anger and our hurt that we feel can be greatly magnified due to the underlying layers of pain that we already carry. So what do we do with all these emotions, even as we try to be disciples, even as we try to grow spiritually? What do we do with all this? How do we move out from under the shadows of unhelpful or unhealthy family influences? And for this portion, I consolidated some points by referring to the work of a psychologist, Dr. Gail Brainer, and to the writings of Henry Nouwen, because they have a lot more expertise and experience in these areas than I do. So one thing that we recognize is that the past isn't about the past. You see, everything that happens actually happens in the present. It can't be any other way. Memories of events are thoughts that are actually occurring in the present. Anger or hurt about the past is happening now. Your present moment experience in the now is what keeps the past alive. What is amazing about this understanding is that it slows you. It shows you that the way out of your suffering is always in the present. You can change your perspective now. You can focus on something different now. And you can feel your feelings as they are right now. And so if we want to heal from the past, we can put our attention on our present moment experiences. The second thing is that memories are not the problem. We sometimes think that we are broken because of all the memories, all the trauma that we've gone through. But a memory is a thought. And a thought has no power or meaning whatsoever unless you give it power or meaning. Does that make sense? A memory is a thought, but it has no power or meaning whatsoever unless you give it power or meaning. You have many thoughts about many things that happened long ago, right? And these thoughts cause no problems for you. But some thoughts are extra sticky. You have an emotional reaction to them. And you think them over and over. It goes over and over in our minds. You may even have beliefs that are related to them. For example, I am justified in thinking this. I should be angry. Or, I need an apology before I can move on. If not, I can't let this go. And this keeps them very much alive and affects our ongoing present-day experience. So if you want to be free from the past, we need to slowly lose interest in those sticky thoughts. Know that it doesn't serve you to repeat them over and over again in your mind, and that thinking they are justified only delays your freedom. 3. Our beliefs about healing can get in the way. You know, we often become aware of our beliefs that we hold on to. And some of the beliefs are not always helpful. And here are some possibilities, right? I feel justified in staying stuck because I was wronged by someone. Or it's someone else's responsibility to make this better for me. If I let go, I'm somehow approving others' bad behavior. Or, I need an apology. Life is unfair. It was so bad that it's not possible for me to heal. So we give ourselves a lot of reasons why. But you know, we are in the present moment. Our life begins now, in this very moment. And we can always start anew. God has always given us that opportunity to start anew. So don't feed these limiting thoughts. Because God is able to give us new thoughts, a new way of being. Most importantly, finding out who you are is the ultimate freedom. If you define yourself by your past, you'll be living as a fraction of what's possible for you. So, for example, if you think that you've been wronged or abused or that you have been a victim in a situation, defining yourself by what happened doesn't help you now. The question is it time to take off this identity of what happened? Sometimes it feels so true to think that we are the result of what happened or the sum total of our thoughts and feelings. But the truest thing about you is that you are aware and that you are a child of God. Life may present an array of experiences, thoughts, emotions, events, people. But these are not you. They don't make up you alone. Who you are is that you are the beloved of God. No one says, the world tells you many lies about who you are. And you simply have to be realistic enough to remind yourself of this. Every time you feel hurt, offended, or rejected, you have to dare to say to yourself, these feelings, strong as they may be, are not telling me the truth about myself. The truth, even though I cannot feel it right now, is that I am the chosen child of God, precious in God's eyes, called the beloved from all eternity and held safe in an everlasting belief. So lastly, it's about us knowing who we are and daring to claim the first love. Jörg brought this up last week. It talks about us going back to our first love. It's not saying that family is not important. It's not saying that church as family is not important. It's saying that all that we are goes back to us knowing that we were first loved by God. And that makes all the difference. Since a spiritual life starts at a moment, at the place where you can hear God's voice, where somehow you can claim that long before your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your school, your church touched you, loved you, and wounded you, long before that, you were held safe in an eternal embrace. You were seen with eyes of perfect love long before you entered into the dark valley of life. The spiritual life starts at the moment that you can go beyond all the wounds and claim that there was a love that was perfect and unlimited long before that perfect love became reflected in the imperfect and limited conditional love of people. The spiritual life starts where you dare to claim the first love. Love one another because I have loved you first, in First John. So we probably know a lot of all this, right? It's probably all not new. But we need to be willing to take the first step towards change. Are we willing to put aside what's not working for us and do something different? Christine Ho Gonzalez said, "Before we can enter into God's new life, we must leave our old one behind. And the only way to fully do this is to die. This, if we consider it seriously, is a terrifying thought, which is presumably why many refuse Jesus' invitation to new life. New life sounds appealing, but death is what most of the world spends all of its energies trying to avoid. In reality, birth and death are both mysterious and incomprehensible in their own ways. Actually, death and birth occur in the same moment, and this is how we are born again. Often Christians speak of being born again as if it happens only once, at the what we call conversion moment. And though this might be true, it's perhaps more useful to think of the spiritual rebirth as something that happens on a seasonal basis, just as it does in nature. We are continually dying, shedding old patterns and ways of being, to receive new life from God, renewed relationships, renewed courage to take the next step of faith, renewed beliefs about God and ourselves, all leading to renewed love for God, ourselves, and others." I think in the context of family, that's what we need to do. To shed old patterns and ways of doing and being and receive new life from God so that we can have renewed relationships, renewed courage to take on the next step of faith, and perhaps renewed beliefs about God and ourselves. And hopefully this all leads to a renewed love for God, ourselves, and others. And that's what Good Friday and Easter is all about, isn't it? It's about dying to our old ways and entering into new life with God. I believe if all of us within this church family is willing to look deep inside ourselves, to work on shedding unhelpful patterns and ways of being, and to journey with each other compassionately, we might witness how God redeems our collective brokenness and creates something new and beautiful out of it. So today, we have a few reflection questions for you. And one is, what old patterns of thinking and ways of being would you like to shed? And two, What new ways of thinking and being would you like to adopt? And three, how would daring to claim the first love of God help you take the first step towards change? Will you join me in prayer? This is the air I breathe. This is the air I breathe. Your holy presence living in me. I'm desperate for you. I'm lost without you. All my ways are known to you. Help us walk in new ways of being, O Lord.